to Breakthrough Business Strategies, and happy Monday to each and every one of you. This is your host, Michelle Price, and on Twitter, at Prosperity Gal, coming to you from the third coast of Houston, Texas today, where we'll bring you information on business success mindset, your inner game, and Web 2.0 tools, techniques, and strategies, your outer game, so that you're equipped to create success in your business today. Now, our listeners have expressed that they are solopreneurs, service-based professionals, and last year, offline businesses learning to come online started identifying themselves, and I was giving out a woohoo for that one, because I love it when businesses are staying current with what's going on and what's going to help their business grow and succeed. You know, having been an entrepreneur for over 30 years and have been a huge supporter of family-owned businesses, I love it when folks start to get it. They learn and they implement and they execute and they achieve those results, and then you just see that gleam in their eye. Kind of reminds me of Santa on Christmas. Now, today, our featured guest is Don Cooper, the sales heretic. You know, he is a national speaker and trainer in sales, and we're going to be focusing on overcoming objections, one of everyone's most dreaded topics. But, you know, one of the things I know you're going to love is by the time the end of the show comes around, you're going to have a totally different perspective on objections, because Don has done an absolutely fabulous job in teaching and training us to how to understand sales better and not be afraid of it. So I'm so grateful that he's joined our team. How are you doing today, Don?
Good morning, Michelle. I am fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. We just started getting a rainstorm, and you know, I'm one of those weird people. I love it when it rains. So where do we even start? I mean, I can tell you that this is a topic that it's funny. As I even talk to people, for example, in my networking group that I go to every Thursday, what I notice is, Don, people seem to be naturally bent toward throwing objections up even in a conversation. So I totally get it when people feel overwhelmed with how do they deal with objections as they come up during the sales process.
Well, objections seem scary. The challenge is what's really scary about them is us. It's the way we react to them. The problem with objections is what we all wish as salespeople, as business owners, as professionals, is that when we make a presentation to a prospect, they'll jump up and say, yes, I'll take it. Give it. Give me, give me, give me, give me, give me. And when we get an objection, that kind of derails that dream. So we fear objections, we dread objections, because we believe that an objection means we're not going to make the sale. And that's simply in our own mind. There's no reality to that. So the first thing that we need to do is to understand what objections really are. If we understand what they are better, then we fear them a lot less. And that's true of anything. The better we understand something, the less we fear it. I have said before, you can't operate effectively out of fear. In sales, in a negotiation, talking with your family, even dealing with friends, you cannot operate effectively out of fear. So you must approach everything head on. You need to understand what it is you're afraid of, to learn more about it, to get more comfortable with it, to eliminate that fear. Only when you have managed to overcome the fear can you be effective in dealing with whatever the issue is. So we understand what exactly objections are, where they stem from, what do they mean. And that's the first thing that I work with people on when I'm doing coaching with them on the subject, or I'm doing a training seminar or speaking on the subject, is what are objections? What we need to understand from a sales perspective is that for our prospect, any purchase is a commitment. And that makes sense, right, Michelle?
Yes.
Whenever we buy anything, it's a commitment. And the bigger the purchase, the bigger the commitment. So buying a candy bar is a very small commitment. If we don't like it, we're not out a whole lot of money. Buying a pair of sunglasses is a somewhat bigger commitment, but again, not huge. Buying a car, that's a much, much bigger commitment. Buying a house, an even bigger commitment. So the bigger any purchase, the more of a commitment that is. And the harder it is to get out of that commitment, the more daunting that commitment is. If you buy a pair of sunglasses and decide later you don't like them, you can probably take them back and get your money back. So while that's a commitment, it's got a nice escape chute. A new car, not so much. You buy a car and don't like it, very often you're out of luck. Now, some companies have started to capitalize on that fear and offering a guarantee. You can bring the car back in 3 days or a week or 30 days. So some companies are starting to recognize that if they can eliminate that fear of commitment a little more, they can increase their sales. If you are a business buyer and you're buying a multi-million dollar computer system, there's no escape route. Once you've made that decision, that's it. There's no going back. So any purchase is a commitment. The bigger the purchase, the bigger the commitment. And the fact is, Michelle, we all have a fear of commitment. It's not just guys.
I was just thinking that. It really isn't just guys. Can I share something? When
sure.
I talk to people in networking events, it's amazing how many women actually have more fear of commitment than men do. So I'm just raising the hand going, ladies, it's not the guys in business or in personal life.
It's everybody, because commitment has a downside. There's fear associated with commitment. And we need to understand what our buyers fear. Because so long as they have that fear will prevent them from buying. So objections are caused by fear. If that fear stays there, they're not going to buy, which means that as a salesperson, and if you're a business owner or a professional, you're still a salesperson. As a salesperson, our job is to alleviate the buyer's fear. When we alleviate that fear, their comfort level goes up, their confidence level goes up, they're more comfortable and confident with their commitment, and then they buy. So that brings up the question, what do buyers fear? Well, they fear a lot of things. Probably the biggest is buying the wrong product. Have you ever done that, Michelle? You bought something and then realized, oh, my God, this is the wrong thing.
Yes, I have.
Happens to all of us. It happens on small purchases, happens on big purchases. We think we like it at the time, but then we get it home or we take it to our office or whatever, we start using it, and we realize this is not what we thought it was going to be. And that might be the case with a product. It can be the case with a service. It can be a vacation destination. We've all been there. You buy something and then afterwards discover this was the wrong thing. I really wish I hadn't bought this. So that's a huge fear, is buying the wrong product. And that's especially important these days when the breadth of choices we have in any category is larger than ever before. There are so many cars to choose from. There are so many digital cameras to choose from. There are so many services of all different kinds to choose from. How do we pick the right one? And that's what our fear is. Even if this one seems good, how do we know there's not one that's better out there? So that's a huge fear, buying the wrong product. Another is buying from the wrong company. You might be able to get the same product or a similar service from a wide variety of companies, but they're not all the same. We want to make sure that we buy whatever we buy from a place that's going to back up what they sell. So if we're buying something like a car or a boat or an RV or a motorcycle, we want to know that we can take it back there if we have a problem and they'll take care of it. We want to make sure that the people in the company are people that are going to be trustworthy, that are going to stand behind what they sell, that are going to take care of if something goes wrong, that are going to be around for us when we need them later on. I learned that lesson the hard way. I bought a piece of exercise equipment a number of years ago. It was a home gym. And I will admit, I bought a cheap one. It seemed like a good deal at the time. But when a cable broke about a year later, I called the company and found they were out of business, which meant my home gym was now almost useless because I couldn't replace this one cable because the company wasn't around. So the product that I bought was a decent product, but I bought it from the wrong company. They weren't around. And that goes for retailers. That goes for service providers. Because you can buy all kinds of things from lots of different places. You want to buy it from the right place. So our fear of choosing the wrong vendor can be huge. Another very big, very common fear is paying too much. Even if you think this is the right product and you think this is the right company, we don't want to pay more than we have to, right? We want
Which
to buy
is funny
everything.
Because, you know, we talk about the myth of price not being there, yet everyone is concerned about paying too much.
Yeah, price is always an issue. It's not the biggest issue. It's not the only issue. But it's always an issue. We'd like to pay as little as possible for whatever we can. And few things drive us crazier than buying something and then discovering it cheaper somewhere else or having it go on sale the following week or discovering somebody else paid less for it from the same company than we did. It's part of the reason people hate card buying so much, because the price you pay is a crapshoot. You and your neighbor could buy the exact same car from the exact same dealership and pay two different prices. So that fear is huge, and it nags at us throughout the entire buying process. And very often, that comes up as a huge objection, is the price, because we want to pay as little as we can. Another fear is buying at the wrong time. And this can be related to the price issue, because what if we buy it now and it goes on sale next week or next month? Or what if interest rates drop next month? So you may get the best price on whatever you're buying now, but interest rates could drop or something else could happen. You know, what if you buy the product right now and it is the right product right now, but a month later, something better comes along. The next generation of whatever it is you bought comes out. If we just delay a little longer, we might get a new option. And that can often be a reason behind delaying tactics. People just want to see what else comes on. So buying at the wrong time is a real common fear. Another is not being able to afford whatever it is they buy. This fear has become much, much greater in the last few years as people have discovered that what they thought they could afford before the recession, they're discovering now they can't afford. People are losing their houses, they're losing their cars, they're losing their boats, they're losing all kinds of things because once they lost their job, they realized they couldn't afford all these things anymore. So even if they can afford it right now, people more and more have uncertainty about being able to afford it down the road. So that can be a reason not to buy something, or at least not to buy it yet. Uncertainty about our own personal futures is a huge barrier to buying behavior. And it's something that most politicians don't realize. Consumer confidence is incredibly important to the economy, and it matters vitally to our prospects. Yet another fear is our spouse or our partner being upset with a purchase. If we make an impulse buy without them knowing about it, what's going to happen when we get home? Or alternatively, on the business side, our boss not being happy with our purchase. What if we buy this and then the boss says, "What are you, an idiot?" And while that fear may be overblown, in our mind, it's huge and it's valid. So very often, we want to run the idea past whoever it is, even if we have the ultimate decision-making authority over that purchase. We still have to live and or work with whoever else is in our sphere of influence. So a spouse or a boss or somebody else being upset with our decision can play a very big factor and create genuine fear. Another one is maintenance costs, maintenance efforts. When you buy something, we want to do as little maintenance as possible. We want those costs to be as low as possible. So the fear of what's going to be involved with the upkeep of whatever we're buying can be a great fear. Something going wrong down the line, a cost we hadn't prepared for, effort we hadn't planned on. All these generate fears. And there are more. These are simply the biggest ones. But these are all the fears that are brewing in the mind of our prospects. Daunting, huh?
Gosh, yeah. You've like, it's funny just listening to you talk about it, Dawn. I can feel all that kind of building inside of me, the tenseness.
Sure. And this is what's happening inside the minds of our prospects. And it's actually kind of a wonder anybody ever buys anything.
That's kind of a great point.
Yeah.
You could get yourself going into a circle with all of that.
And that's very often what happens. When a prospect doesn't buy from us, more often than not, it's because one or more of those fears were in their head and it didn't get alleviated. So that's where objections stem from. An objection is a reflection of one or more of those fears. And if we deal with it effectively, if we can alleviate that fear, then we're closer to making the sale. But if we don't deal with it, or if we don't deal with it effectively, that fear stays there, and that fear will prevent them from buying from us. So we need to understand that that's what an objection means. They have a fear of some type, and we need to deal with that fear. We need to help them through that fear. So it means
so
you
can
can't...
Can I ask a question at this point?
Sure. Absolutely.
If a client has three different fear tapes that are playing in their head from past experiences, what's going to be a way to actually uncover them all? Because a lot of times people are guarded about telling you what their fears are.
Yes,
they don't
they
want to look bad, and they don't want to share with you what's going on in their head, which is why I find sales really frustrating.
That's correct. You're absolutely right, Michelle. People very often don't tell us what their genuine fears are. So they give us an objection instead. So the objection stems from the fear, but may not actually reflect the actual fear. That's why you can't simply tackle an objection head on. You need to use a five-step process. It's what I call the five R's for overcoming objections. The first R is relax. Too many salespeople, when they hear an objection, panic. They freak out.
Yeah,
they go crazy because they're afraid they've just lost a sale. Somebody says, well, this is too much, or they say, well, I need to have my spouse take a look at it, or I need to do this or something else. And the first thought of the salesperson is, oh, my God, it's over. I've just wasted all my time. I might as well die now. So the first step is just relax. Don't panic. Take a breath and recognize that objections are normal. What's rare is for the prospect not to have an objection. That's highly unusual.
Should that be a red flag if someone doesn't have an objection? Is that a possibility that could be someone who comes back later?
It can be a red flag in that if someone doesn't object, there's good odds they're not interested anymore. Because think about it this way, Michelle. When you go to buy something and somebody makes a presentation, once you've decided you don't actually want this and you're already firm in your mind, do you bother to object or do you just walk away?
Yeah, I showed disinterest.
Yeah. When you've decided you don't want it, when you've made up your mind already, you don't bother to object because you don't want to waste any more time. If you object, they'll keep talking. You don't want that. So if you decided already that this is not right for you, you say, okay, well, thank you, and you leave as quickly as you can. So a lack of objections can be a bad sign. An objection is actually a good sign. An objection is a buying signal, because if you object, it means you're interested. There's just some kind of a fear you've got that needs to be dealt with. So when you hear an objection, don't think I've lost the sale. Think the opposite. I'm close to the sale.
Oh, wow. Talk about a mindset shift.
Yes, exactly. Reframe how you view objections. They're not negatives. They're positives. If you don't get an objection, odds are they're done. They've checked out. If you get an objection, they're interested. They want more information from you. They'll rejoice when you hear an objection. Recognize it means you're closer to the sale now. That's the first step, is to shift your mind so that you don't panic, so that you relax, so that you can deal with this now. However, dealing with it does not mean answering it. Because what you said earlier is absolutely correct. The fear that they have is not always reflected in the objection they make. Because they might say, well, this is too expensive, when price isn't really the issue. There's something else going on. Or they might say, well, my boss needs to take a look at this first, when their boss doesn't need to. But that's an excuse to put off the decision because of some other fear. Very often, the objection we hear is not the real issue. So the second R is research. Don't take what the prospect says at face value, because odds are the objection you hear is not the real objection. And one way to determine what the real objection is to use a tactic I call the turnaround. Turn the objection around into a question. So if the prospect says, this is too expensive, turn that around into a question. Too expensive? If someone says, this is too small, you might respond by saying, when you say too small, what do you mean exactly? Whatever it is they object with, turn that around. Make it a question. Let them explain some more. Think of an objection like a dandelion. Michelle, if you've got a dandelion in your lawn, if you take that dandelion and you grab the stem and yank it out, what happens?
It grows back.
It grows right back because you didn't get the root. The stem and the flower are the symptom. The problem is the root. The same is true with an objection. What they say is merely the stem and the flower. The real issue, the real fear, is the root. That's what's buried down there that we have to uncover. So when you said earlier that people won't often share their real fear, you're correct. That's absolutely true. That's the root. They don't want to show the root, so they show that stem and that flower instead. So if you just deal with the stem and the flower, you're in trouble, because that's not the issue. What we need to do is to ask additional questions, to dig down, research further, until we uncover that root, whatever that might be. And that might take a few minutes, because one question might lead to something, but not the real root, which means you need to ask another question and keep asking and give them time to talk and let them explore. They might not even be completely certain consciously what the real fear is. So it may take us a while to dig to help them uncover it for themselves. Or they might not yet be comfortable with us enough to share what that real root is. So talking a little more helps to build additional trust for them to feel comfortable enough to share the root with us. The key though is asking questions, probing, researching. Doing so in a friendly manner, doing so with an attitude of helpfulness and service. You don't want to be accusatory. And in this process, a question you absolutely want to stay away from is the question, why?
Okay, Michelle, do I get to say why?
Go right ahead.
Why do we want to stay away from the question, why?
Why questions have a subtext to them. Michelle, if I were to ask you, why do you think that? Or why is that important to you? Or why did you do that?
Yeah, it makes me feel like I have to justify to you.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Why questions have an accusatory tone to them. The subtext to a why question is, you're an idiot. Now, that's not what we mean when we ask a why question. That's not our intent, but that's the subtext that's attached to the question. So rather than ask a why question, which puts your prospect on the defensive, change the format a little bit. Make it a how question or a what question, and that changes the tone. So instead of asking, why do you think that, you could ask, how did you come to think that? Or why is that important to you? You could ask, what's the reason that's important to you? Instead of why did you do that, you might ask, what caused you to do that? Same three questions, but now each one is a different tone. That accusatory element is gone. So it sounds like we're curious, we want to know more. It makes us sound like we're ignorant and need you to enlighten us. That increases the prospect's level of comfort and confidence. Doesn't make them have to justify themselves. They don't feel like they're on the defensive. They now feel that we're interested and want to know more. It's a completely different dynamic.
Yeah, it feels different too. Because even when you were just asking me the question, I could feel that in my body, like, oh, back off, dude.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. That's the power of a why question. And it's tough to break ourselves of that habit because as kids, what's the first question we learn to ask?
Why?
Yeah.
Why, Mommy?
We ask that all day long. It's a natural question. Because we're curious. So wondering why is a great thing. Asking why, though, using that specific word, can be dangerous because of the way it makes the prospect feel. So this can be a challenge. But if you can train yourself to substitute what and how questions for why questions, you will find your conversations improve dramatically. So when you're talking with a prospect or a coworker or your boss or a friend or a family member, just making that one change can make a huge difference in the tone of the conversation and how you are perceived by others. And for this stage of the objection handling process, that's a critical element. It's a little tiny element, and yet it's critical.
It sounds like number two, it'll take you, if you make sure you use that little pivotal point, that's going to be the difference between success or failure.
It can be, absolutely. And step two in this process can take some time. And the key is not to rush it. Too many salespeople are too anxious to get right to the answer to the objection. But this portion of the process is vital to a more effective answer later on. So don't be afraid to spend 5 or 10 minutes on just this part of the process, because it can take that long to uncover what the truth is from the prospect. Remember, you cannot deal with the stem and the flower. You must deal with the root. So the third step in this process, the third R, is to rate the importance of the objection. How big an issue is this? Any given prospect may have several objections. They're not all the same. Some objections are huge. They're deal breakers. If you can't resolve this issue, deal's off. Other objections are minor. They're so small, they're almost inconsequential. Do you think it matters which is which?
Well, yeah, it does. Of course, you know, my next question is going to be, how do you get them to be honest about which is more important?
Ask them to prioritize. Just ask, how big an issue is this? And remember, the objection handling process comes near the end of the sales process. If you remember when I talked about the Tao of Selling, really the key to sales is doing great needs analysis up front, doing great questioning, learning what the prospect's wants, needs, fears, concerns, values, priorities are. So when you get to this part of the process, you should already know what's important to them. You should know what their issues are, what their values are, what their priorities are. So when they bring something new, you can then help them figure out where that belongs, given the information you already have. So you can ask, you know, given the other things you said were important to you, A, B, C, D, and E, how important is this to you? Where does this fit? How big an issue is this to you compared to everything else we've discussed already? So you want to figure out what's really important to them and what's not. The things that are not important, you don't need to worry about. That can be resolved simply, quickly, or in some cases doesn't need to be resolved at all. The bigger ones, though, those are the ones you need to deal with. So don't drive yourself crazy. Find out how big the issue is, how important is it going to be to resolve it. And that goes along with how easily will you be able to resolve this objection. Because some objections are really easy to resolve. Others can be resolved with some more effort. Others are really tough to resolve but can be done. And still other objections can't be resolved. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. So you want to figure out how important any given objection is and how easy that objection is going to be to resolve. It's tempting now to jump into the answer. This is still not yet the right time, though. There's a fourth R. That fourth R is...
Don, funny you should say the word, though, Don. It's tempting to give the answer.
Uh-huh.
Let me ask you a question, please, in this part of our process, because here's what I noticed came up as I was listening to you share this with us. You know, people will ask us lots of questions just like we ask them questions when we're doing this whole process or dance with one another. What I notice from my perspective is they keep asking questions around the process of, because a lot of what I do is information.
Right.
Okay, so they keep asking questions around trying to uncover the information without buying. Is
right.
that, how can I express this question? They mix it in when we're talking about objections. And I'm kind of like, well, wait a minute, if I tell you that, then you have what I'm trying to sell you.
Right.
How do you redirect the conversation, or what's the best thing to do when that happens?
Well, when somebody's asking for that kind of information, it's a reflection that they have a fear of buying the wrong thing or buying from the wrong person.
Ah.
They want to know what your process is because they want to be able to know that that's the right process or to be able to compare that process with somebody else's. They don't want to take you on faith. So that fear is buying the wrong product, service, or buying from the wrong company. That's what's driving that particular objection.
And if they really understood the process, they still wouldn't have a need for either one of us, no matter who delivers it. So when you're in the process of answering those objections and you're having to think on your feet, how do you handle that?
Okay. Go through these five steps.
Ah, okay.
So repeat the question back to them, rephrase that back to them, probe to find out what the reason they want to know that information, determine how big of an issue that is for them, and then come to the fourth R, which is to review. So rather than jump right into the answer, take a moment to review with them what the two of you have discussed about this objection. And there are two big reasons you want to review their objection with them. First, you want to make certain that you fully understand everything about their objection. Number two, they need to feel that you understand them. So on the one hand, we need to understand and be certain that we do. On the other hand, they need to feel that they have been understood.
I totally agree with that, because if I don't feel like you understand me, I turn you out. I turn
Precisely.
You off, I turn you out.
Yeah, Michelle, have you ever dealt with a salesperson in buying anything, and you made an objection, and they answered the objection even before you finished getting it out of your mouth?
Yes.
And how did that make you feel?
Like, okay, shut up, twit, and listen to what I've got to say, because you don't really understand what I just expressed to you.
Precisely. So by listening effectively, asking questions, and then reviewing, it creates the opposite feeling. It creates the sense that you have been listened to, you have been understood, and therefore you've been valued. So your thoughts, your opinion has been heard, recognized, valued as important. So this process, this review, helps to create additional respect and trust. And that sets up our answer. So when we answer them, we're now answering from a position of increased respect and trust. So this is where we finally come to step five. The fifth R is respond. And there are lots of different ways that you can respond to an objection. One can be to explain. And that's what you might do in a situation where people are asking for more information about your process. You can explain. I understand the reason you're asking for that information. It makes sense, and I don't blame you for wanting to know that. Here's the reason I can't tell you everything about that. Because what you're asking for is my proprietary information. What you're asking me to do is to provide you with my information without charging you anything for it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it comes across totally different when you've gone through the process you just shared with us. Because
exactly.
If I say it before, I'm going to come across as being arrogant.
Yep. So very often, explaining the reason behind something is a good way to answer an objection. Very often, if it's a price objection, if they're saying, well, you know, you cost twice as much as they do, an explanation can be in order. Well, here are the reasons why our product or our service costs so much more. Theirs has this and that and the other. We have these plus this and this and this and this. So often explaining is a good way to answer an objection. Another can be to reframe, because sometimes what the prospect sees as a problem can be to their advantage. Well, I don't like this feature here. You might reframe that. I understand the reason you're not crazy about that. However, here's what this does, and here's how this benefits you. So sometimes you might take their issue and help them see that issue in a different light. Remember, the prospect is not the expert on your product or service. You are. So it's up to you to educate the prospect when they don't know any better. I tell people all the time, when it comes to a lot of different products and services, I'm an idiot. I have no idea how all kinds of things work. I am so ignorant, I often don't know what to ask. And I'm normal. There's too much information out there. We cannot possibly have it all. So there are lots of things that I just don't understand and need to be educated about. And if I'm not educated properly, odds are I'll make a bad buying decision. So that's what I need you for. I need you to educate me so I don't make that buying mistake that I'm so afraid of. So you might reframe the issue. Another way to deal with an objection is to help your prospect prioritize it. So you might review what they said their priorities were with them. Well, you said earlier that quality was the single most important factor to you and that reliability was the second most important factor to you and delivery was the third most important factor to you. Is price actually now more important than all those things, or is it less important than those things? In other words, take what they said earlier in your needs analysis part of the sales process and present it back to them to counter their objection. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and I'm thinking over here in my head, wouldn't you also have to be careful in how you word that so that you don't come across as being flippant again?
Yep, absolutely. You have to start
so even
by
with
going.
The process as you're teaching us, we have to be careful how we deliver either the answers or the questions so that it comes across as really sincerely wanting to help.
That's exactly correct. And you must have that attitude the entire time. So when you're presenting this as an option, you want to make sure that you're coming across as being of service. You want to help them make the right decision, not that you're being arrogant. So you might say, I just want to, I want to check this. I want to make sure I'm correct. You can say, can you help me out? You can say, let me ask you this. Because you do want to come across as confident. You want to be confident in your price. You want to be confident in your product. You want to be confident in your company. You want to be confident in yourself. So you make sure that those come across. Now, another way to deal with an objection is to counter it with a different fear. I've been asked more than once, we do a great job talking about our benefits, and yet all the prophet can do is focus on the negatives. Well, that's because there are two kinds of people in the world. There are those that tend to look on the bright side all the time and see all the potential benefits, and there are those who look on the negative side all the time. All they see are potential problems. So if you've got a fear-based prospect, it doesn't matter how great your product or service is. They're going to focus on their fears. The way to deal with a fear-based individual is to talk to them about a different fear.
What would that look like?
It might look like if they're complaining about price, you might say, well, which would be worse, paying 10% more or having this break down when you need it most? Our reliability is superior to the competition, so it's up to you to decide which is the bigger issue. I was talking with somebody a week ago, and he was telling me about a friend that sold super deluxe high-end baby strollers. These are literally the most expensive baby strollers on the market. They are also the safest baby strollers on the market. And whenever she was faced with a price objection, she would counter it by saying, only you can decide how safe you want your baby to be. Made the sale every single time. Because she was countering the fear of paying a high price with the fear of something happening to the child.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no. I can see how that would be helpful. I can see how the fear-based people might still come back at that. But
they might, because they're fear-based. That's what they do. But
right.
The best way to deal with a fear-based person is to meet them head-on, fear for fear. Help them choose which fear is worst, because their priority is alleviating their own fears. They need to choose between fear. They're not choosing between fear and benefit. They can't do that. That's not the way their brains work. They simply choose the smallest fear. Whatever fear seems to have the least consequences, that's the one they go with.
So for us to kind of play this out, maybe so people can hear it, if you were her and you said to me, how'd you put it? Only you can decide
how safe
you
want your
baby.
Child to be.
Okay, so if I'm the person that she's talking to, what if I say, well, I hear you, but all my friends have bought these, you know, this, and this stroller, and nothing's happened to their children. So why should I invest twice as much with yours?
There are a number of ways to respond to that. And one might be, you never know. Or you can say, they've chosen adequate. Is adequate good enough for you?
Hmm. Yeah, I can see how it all, of course, each situation is going to be totally different, and you're going to have to read their intensity and decide what, would you give them back the same intensity that they gave you?
Pretty much. You've got to be true to yourself. You've got to bring your own personality to this. This is why there are lots of different tactics to use, because what works for you might not work for me, which might not work for any one of our listeners.
Okay.
So you always want to make sure that you are comfortable and confident in whatever approach you're using. Now, here's another great way to respond to an objection, and this is a terrific, very versatile approach. It's called the feel, felt, found technique. This is a classic sales tactic. The way it works is, I understand how you feel. A lot of our other customers have felt the same way, and what they've found is. So what we're doing is first acknowledging the feeling behind the objection. So we're addressing that fear. Then we're saying that others have felt the same way, so we're validating that fear. The subtext of that phrase is, you're not an idiot. That's a perfectly reasonable concern because others have shared it. You're not alone. and what they found. So here's the actual reality. Here's what you can expect. Here's the reason. You don't need to fear because of other people's experiences. And the key in this sentence is the word and. Too often, when people use this technique, they use but. I understand how you feel. Others have felt the same way. But what they found, the problem with the word but is, what does but do to everything that came before it?
It invalidates it. It's one of those words I tell people to eliminate from their conversation.
Exactly. But negates whatever came before it. So all the work you've done in setting up the acknowledgement and the validation are now gone. And is a linkage word. So use and as the bridge between the validation and the next reality. And this is a great all-purpose objection handling tool. It's sort of the Swiss Army knives of objection handling tools.
And people might have to get into the habit of doing that one. Even I catch myself saying but once in a while.
Yep, absolutely.
And what I notice is it usually comes up when I'm getting frustrated, which kind of goes back to your number one.
Sure. Now,
that
there's
also
another.
Makes me think of another question, though, Dawn.
Sure.
And you're always really great in letting us kind of dig down into these things so people can feel the practicality of it. Now, I understand you're real comfortable with this process. Surely even you sometimes can get agitated or lose your patience with people. When you feel that rising up inside you, what do you do to bring yourself back to that centered state so that you can continue to be helpful in the process instead of just going, all right, I've had enough?
I try to empathize with my prospect and put myself in their shoes and think to myself, they're afraid of something. It's not their fault. There's a fear there, and I need to help them deal with it. So I put on my psychologist's hat. I try to think of myself less as a salesperson and more of a psychoanalyst. And what do psychologists do?
They ask questions and let people kind of process.
Precisely. That's exactly it. So we have a lot in common with psychologists and psychiatrists. Buying is an emotional issue. Buying is all psychological. Now, there are times, if the objection is significant enough, when the best answer is to ditch what you were trying to sell them and instead show them something else. Because you might have picked out a product for them that seemed right at the time, but based on this objection that came up later, well, this isn't the right product after all. And you show them a whole different product that then solves that objection.
Now, how do you shift that conversation so they don't feel like you're just trying to find something else to sell them?
You can say, well, based on what we talked about, I thought this would be the right thing for you, but because of what you just said, this would be a better product for you. Always relate everything you're doing back to what they said. So it might be something bigger, it might be something less expensive, it might be something that might be two different things. But figure out what's the best option. So these are all different ways that you can answer an objection, but in order for any of them to work effectively, it needs to be the fifth of these five steps. I was looking at sports cars a few years ago, and I test drove a Mazda RX-8. Great car. I liked it. Took it out for a test drive. I got it back to the dealership, and the salesperson said, what did you think? I said, well, I liked it, but I really didn't like the digital speedometer. He says, oh, you get used to it.
Oh.
Wrong answer.
Yeah. I just threw a whole wall up for me.
Exactly. Yeah. What was he doing? What was the result? What was the undertone?
He was invalidating your objection. Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. The subtext of what he said was, you're a moron. And, you know, call me crazy. I don't like feeling like a moron. I might be one, but I don't want to feel that way. So what he should have done instead was he should have taken a moment to think and reflect and relax and then say, Mr. Cooper, when you say you didn't like it, what specifically did you not like about it? So rather than jumping into an answer, he should have first relaxed collected his thoughts, and then researched, find out what I meant by that. And then asked me questions until he got to what my real objection, my real concern, my real fear was. And then he could have rated the importance. Well, Mr. Cooper, based on all the things that are important to you in your next sports car, how important is the speedometer to determine if that's just a little tiny irritation or if it's a deal breaker or somewhere in between? And then he could have reviewed everything with me. So, Mr. Cooper, if I understand you correctly, you're concerned because this car has a lot of power and you like going fast anyway. On the other hand, you really don't want to get a lot of speeding tickets, and you're concerned that you won't be able to easily tell how fast you're going at any point in time. Is that correct? Now, I could have responded to him, and he could have said, Mr. Cooper, I understand exactly how you feel. In fact, a lot of the people who have test driven this car have felt the same way. Because we're all used to analog speedometers. It's what we all grew up with. And here's what they have found after they've driven this car for a while. They get used to a digital speedometer as quickly and easily as they got used to an analog speedometer in the first place. Now, Michelle, does that answer sound different?
Oh, totally.
Notice.
Now you sound like you actually care about me, and you're letting me decide what level of importance it has so that the choice is truly mine.
Right. Notice, it's basically the same answer. You get used to it. But the process sets up the answer differently. And now it's a much more respectful answer. And now it's based on something. It's based on other people's experiences, not merely the assertion of a salesperson who has a commission at stake. So the process sets up the answer and makes the answer much more likely to be accepted by your prospect. However, there will be times when there is no good way to answer an objection. It can't be overcome, and you simply have to accept it. That's okay. You'll never overcome every objection. It can't be done because there's no such thing as the perfect product or the perfect service. It has never been created. It never will be created because no matter how well any particular product or service happens to meet any particular person's wants and needs, it could still be cheaper. Nothing is perfect. You don't have to overcome every objection. Often you can make the sale even despite someone's objection without overcoming it. Because everything we buy, Michelle, is a compromise. The question is, what is your prospect willing to compromise on, and what are they not willing to compromise on? And that's information that we should find out well before this part of the process. Back during that needs analysis phase, back when we're learning about what their wants, needs, fears, values, and priorities are. So everything is a compromise. The question is our product or service the right compromise for them? And sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. There are times when a competitor's product or service is simply a better fit for them. That's okay. You're never going to make every sale, no matter what you do. And sometimes one of the best things you can say to a prospect is, this isn't the right thing for you. It's better for you. It's better for them. Because you do not want to persuade a prospect to buy from you when you know that's not in their best interest.
No, because then you got to deal with them afterwards.
Precisely. It's nothing but headaches and problems for everybody concerned. There are times when not pursuing the sale is the best course of action.
You know, we had an interesting comment come up from Michael in Oregon. He's listening to when I asked the question about frustration, and he said he believes frustration signals that there's a blocked goal or an unachieved agenda.
That's true. Our goal is to make the sale.
Right.
Our prospect's goal is usually, not always, but usually, to buy something. So an objection is a barrier between those, and being unable to get that barrier out of the way causes frustration, more so for us than for them, because we usually feel the pressure a lot more.
Mm. That reminds me of, and I can't remember which show, but when you talked about, probably when we were talking about needs analysis and being able to uncover what their true needs were, that the pressure is really on the salesperson, not on the person buying.
Absolutely. That was back in the Dowell selling program that we did. The buyer always can walk away. They can always decide later. Their butt's not on the line, usually. Ours are. We need to make that sale. So we feel a lot more pressure than they do. The challenge for us is when we let that pressure become overwhelming for us. When we operate out of fear and desperation, we can't function effectively.
What are some of the things, Don, after listening to that, what are some of the things that you do for yourself so that you're in a balanced mindset when you're dealing with people?
One of the things that I do, and all the listeners can do this as well, I create ahead of time a list of my most common objections. And when I'm coaching somebody or when I'm doing training or speaking at an event, this is something that I advise people to do. You already know what your most common objections are. Make a list of those things and then create answers for them. That way, when you hear an objection, you'll have a lot more confidence because you already know a good answer to that objection. And that makes it a little easier to have the patience to go through this process because you already know where you're going to end up. If you take every objection from scratch and place one off the cuff, you're going to be floundering a lot. You need to know exactly what you're going to say, where you're trying to get to. When you know that ahead of time, you can breathe a lot easier, you can relax a lot more, you don't feel the pressure to jump right to the answer. You can take your time and help your prospect feel more comfortable with the process.
It almost sounds like as well, whenever you have an opportunity to talk with someone and it wasn't a success for you, to take some time afterwards and go write down what went on during that process. What were the things that they brought up and I wasn't able to answer to their satisfaction, because that's showing you where you need to shore up your skills a little bit.
You're absolutely right, Michelle. After every sales call, whether it's on the phone, in person, whether it's an initial prospecting call or a closing attempt, you should do a debrief afterwards. Do a self-evaluation. What did I do right? What could I have done differently? What seemed to work? What did I forget to do? What did I do I've never done before? How well did that work? What could I change for next time? Because every sales call was different. And our growth as salespeople should be never-ending. So we should always be trying new things. We should always be open to new experiences.
You know, this whole quarter where you've just been sharing with us, what I have to say is a totally different perspective than all of the other sales books and courses and things that I've learned over the past 30 years. It feels a lot, it feels easier, feels more congruent to who I am. And I just want to thank you, Don, because what I notice is usually if I'm really digging and grooving it, that means the listeners are too, because they got attracted to the show because of the way I communicate. There's something there that attracted them to want to, you know, follow and listen and pay attention to what goes on here. And I have to say, you don't give that same old, gosh, I don't know a nice way to say it, tired, lame, come up with your list of pros and cons and do your Benjamin Franklin and write a list down of everybody you know. And I'm like, oh, my God, if that didn't work the past 50 times, what makes you think it's going to work now?
Exactly. Well, thank you, Michelle. I take that as a very high compliment, because that's my goal, to help people feel more comfortable about selling and recognize that anybody can sell within their own values.
And I think what you said right there is really, really key. Anybody can sell within their own values, because that's some of the biggest objections I hear people give when they talk about sales and selling and what they don't like about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and everyone always tells us everyone is selling all the time. And while we understand that from an intellectual perspective, from a personal perspective, we're kind of like, so what? That doesn't help me to tell me that. What will help me is a way I can actually wrap my brain around it so that I'm able to stay congruent with who I am during the process.
Yeah, exactly. Selling is not about convincing people to buy stuff they don't need and or want. Selling is simply about helping people acquire the things that they need and want, and helping them acquire the right things from the right company at the right time at the right price.
Well, oh, it sounds so simple coming out your mouth. And I'm looking forward to where we're going to journey with you in 2011, because I have a feeling that there's a whole lot more we can learn from the mind of the sales heretic.
I'm looking for it too as well, Michelle.
I want to thank everyone for joining us today. You know, we've had an awesome time with Don. We always do. He really is great at helping us to understand the sales process and to be able to do it in a way that allows us to stay congruent with who we are. As he says, sell within our values. And so I want to invite you this week to follow Don, tweet with him, ask him questions, and start doing some of the things that he shared with you today. You know, take a debriefing 5-10 minutes after any time you are talking with a prospect and uncover, you know, what did I do well, what did I not do well, what could I do better next time, and then start applying some of these great things that he shared with you today. So thank you so much for joining us here this Monday at Breakthrough Business Strategies Radio. We look forward to seeing you next Monday.